Okay, this is May 1st, 2004 in Salt Lake City, Utah at the 71st EVAC reunion. And I'm with Sharon, to go by Sam, Alden.
Alden.
And I'm Kara Buick. So we'll just start with where you grew up. Where were you born, raised?
Well, that gets complicated right from the get-go. I'm an Army grad.
Okay.
So I was born in Fort Benning, and I grew up kind of all over the place. Went to Germany, California, and Virginia, and Georgia, and Kansas. And I went to high school in Spain. Also, my senior year, and I was in Pennsylvania. So just kind of moved around. My dad was career, and my mother had been a nursery.
Where did she serve in?
She was in Europe. That's how they met. He was, oh, this is her. He was wounded. And she was a nurse in a hospital in, get this, Paris. And she was taking care of him. And, this is actually a pretty good story.
Uh-huh.
My dad was a great practical joker. I mean, he's a funny, funny man. But there was one thing that he couldn't. He had an appointment to the Naval Academy, but he didn't accept it because he's brought home and he gets seasick. Alright? So it wasn't such a good thing to go to the Naval Academy, so he didn't. But he played jokes on my mother. He would take his thermometer and put it on the radiator by his bed. So she'd come out, Captain Stanley, I see you have a temperature of 112. You know, and stuff like that. So he was begging her. He was going to go back to England for a little R&R before he was shipped back into World War II. And he said, just get me on a plane to England. She said, oh, don't you worry, Captain Stanley. I'll make sure that you get on the plane. He was on the worst deck of the leakiest boat that crossed the English Channel on the stormiest day. And so that, I guess, the time I fell in love. So they were married over there.
Uh-huh.
Two weddings, one in Germany. They had a religious ceremony there, but Germany had no government, and they had a civil ceremony in Holland. And then I was born about a little over a year later in Georgia.
Do you think that's kind of what pushed you to the career path you chose?
Well, I never really thought about it growing up. I didn't want to be a nurse. I didn't know what I wanted to be until probably about October or November of my senior year. And I thought it was probably maybe time to make a few decisions, like which schools do I want to apply to and stuff like that. And so my dad was at the War College at the time, and which is only a 1-year assignment. So I didn't want to be in the same town with my parents, but I didn't want to be on the other side of the country either. So I said, well, Dad, you know, where do you think they're going to send you? And he said, well, I put in for these places. And so I figured out schools in that area, but then what am I going to major in? And I just decided that I really liked biology,
mm-hmm.
so I would be a nurse. There's no logic there.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the 60s, women were nurses or secretaries or teachers. And that's pretty much what we did. Or moms, stay-at-home moms. And I didn't see myself getting married right away and having children right away. So I thought, well, nursing, okay, that sounds pretty cool. Well, I wound up applying to a couple of schools, one of them being Duke, and was accepted. And my dad didn't think I was going to get in because I applied kind of late, and I had been in school overseas
mm-hmm.
for most of high school. And he was so afraid I was going to be accepted, but he never said anything. But he sort of gulped at the tuition and said, okay, wherever you want to go to school. And then once I got into nursing school, I realized that you might as well go into the Army. And the Army had a program where they would pay for up to your last 2 years in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then you owed them what they had paid for plus one. So I can go in the Army for 3 years, that would be bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wound up in the Army. Sarah McVicker, I don't know if you've talked to her yet. My dad swore both of us in together. She was at UNC, University of North Carolina, and I was at Duke. Morning on the same day, went to basic training together. And I had a
mm-hmm.
had a bunch of career pathways that kept crossing over the years. So.
Uh-huh.
That's how I wound up in nursing.
Uh-huh. So was your program a BSN program?
Yeah.
did you think anything about the war, or was it just the money that pissed you?
Well, it was the tuition. I mean, it was the money that attracted me first.
Uh-huh.
Although that's not totally true, because I felt like, since I was an Army grad, I really liked the Navy uniforms better.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I was being terribly unfaithful if I did that. And so I just had to talk with myself, and I realized that there was no way I was going to do anything but the Army.
Uh-huh.
And I loved the Army. I loved growing up in the Army. I absolutely adored everything except my senior year in high school. And, you know, changing schools between your junior and senior year is tough. And I've been 4 years at school in Spain, and all my friends, and, you know, it was great drama and trauma at the time. But I really absolutely loved the opportunities I had because my dad was in the military, in the Army, and I wouldn't have had those kinds of opportunities. Both of my parents really enjoyed it. I had some friends in high school, but their father loved it. He loved it being in the Army. But their mother was very unhappy. She hated the food. She hated the packing. She hated the unpacking. It was such a chore. It was such a pain. It was always disruptive and everything. And so the kids, my friends, were not particularly happy with growing up in the Army. But my mom thought it was fun. She had been in the Army grad. And she really enjoyed it. And I think because my parents enjoyed it so much, it was something that I saw as a positive thing. I didn't really think too much about the war until my dad went. My dad went to Vietnam in 1967. And he was there from February 67 to February 68. So he came back just a few months before I graduated from college. And so I paid a little bit more attention that year when he was gone. I mean, that was his third war, because he'd been in World War II, Korea, and then Vietnam. He got a lot of Purple Heart in Vietnam, but he didn't tell us that when we got back. So I guess I had paid a little bit more attention to it, but my attention was focused on, was my dad safe? Not necessarily the rightness or the wrongness of the whole thing. Didn't really get into protesting one way or another, pro or con, although I did write a letter to the editor of the school newspaper, Duke, because there had been some fairly vicious article in the paper that was published once, you know, warmonger, baby killer kind of stuff. And I had just written what a bunch of BS I think that was, and that wasn't accurate. People weren't like that. I knew these people. I had grown up with these people. I knew that was not what was happening. If it was, these were criminals that were doing the wrong thing at the wrong place at the wrong time, no matter where they would. You know, they probably would have done it wherever they were. That was my sort of one episode of that. And one time there was a sleep-in at the University President's house that spring. And so I went just to kind of see what was going on, and was dating a guy who was really into good stuff and into the anti-war movement and all that. So I sort of went and came around and see what was going on. And I wound up staying there overnight, but I thought, I have nothing in common really with these folks. Most of them were freshmen and sophomores. I was a And really, there was kind of almost a generational shift between the freshmen and sophomores and my class of 68 and like the class of 67 and 66. The freshmen, they would have been the class of 70 or 71. They were the ones that were really brought marijuana onto the campuses and, you know, really kind of introduced that whole drug culture and that was getting pretty rampant in the colleges at the time. Those were the classes that brought my class. Well, I mean, we still had to wear skirts to class and hose, and, you know, we had to wear suits for the football games. All dressed up. Did basketball, a different story. That was always weird, but still is. But it was just, to me, the war was just not something I really paid paid all that much attention to. And I had friends whose parents, whose fathers were over there. I had a friend of a friend whose father was killed over there. But most of my friends were officers' kids like I was. And so their fathers were colonels and lieutenant colonels and generals and very senior people. You didn't lose a whole lot of those people. They were, I mean, my friend whose father was killed was a lieutenant colonel, which was unusual. But that was when, that was like in 67, when it sort of started to heat up a lot more, leading into 1068 and the real difficult parts of the war, 68, 60, late 67, 68, and 69, that were kind of most intense and costly in terms of lives.
Do you find out that you and your dad was gone?
No, he swore me in between my sophomore and junior year.
Oh, okay.
In July.
Okay.
And we were PFCs. Mm-hmm. Sarah and I were private first class in the Army Student First Program, which is so official. And we got $100 a month, mm-hmm. and paid for tuition and books and room and board. And we didn't have to do anything. And, you know, when school was out, we didn't have to. Now you have to be in ROTC. The only nursing scholarships they have now programs are through ROTC. But then, I mean, we didn't have to go to any drills. We didn't have any uniforms. We didn't do anything except go to class, go to the hospital, do our thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we didn't go to basic training until we passed the state board. So I didn't go to basic training until August, took state boards in July, graduated in June, took state boards in July, and went to Fort Sam. Not the best time to go to
Yeah. Had you talked to a recruiter, or did you just kind of sign up on
No, track? No. I called the recruiter and said, this is what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, fine. Well, they had nurse recruiters at that point.
Uh-huh.
And she was just tickled pink and was more than accommodating in terms of getting my dad to swear us in. And she thought that was fine. And mm-hmm. I have a picture of her. She was a rather starchy-looking lady, but... you know, we made her numbers go up. And I don't know if Sarah had talked to her recruiter or not, but I certainly did. I did. Filled out the paperwork.
And what was Fort Sam like?
Oh, God, Fort Sam was fun. Fort basic training for the medical folks, whether you were a physician or nurse or dentist or whatever, but allied health folks, they didn't teach you how to be a nurse or a doctor or a vet or a pharmacist or whatever. They taught you how to do what you already had been trained to do the Army way. So really it was, how to wear your uniform. What were the serious things you needed not to do? Were seriously proposing. What things you needed to do, you know, what, just some general, a general orientation to the Army. They took us out to Camp Bullis, which was, at the time was located outside of San Antonio. It's since been surrounded by suburbs. But at the time, there were cows and snakes and all kinds of stuff out there. And we had to do land navigation, and we went, and the way they treated women was so funny. When we had our weapons familiarization, notice I said familiarization, not qualification, because we were officers, if we ever put our dainty little fingers on a weapon, it would be a 45. And so we were all sitting in this little grandstand, like a little bleacher thing. And they passed around a couple of 45s, empty, no clip. And they collected them. And then they came out with a box and they passed around the clips that were also empty, no ammunition. Never saw a bullet. And they passed that around and said, well, if you noticed on the 45, you know, the handle, it's empty at the bottom, that's where the clip goes. You just sort of shove it up there. And there's a safety on there, but you won't be, don't worry about it. If you need it, we'll show you how to do it. You know, nothing about cleaning weapons, nothing about maintenance, nothing in terms of self-defense. I mean, there was no, not even self-defense for, you know, hand-to-hand, like jujitsu or karate or just a few common things like that. Which would have been useful for dealing with patients, actually. But we didn't get any of that. Then they took us over to another firing range, and we sat in some more bleachers, and some guys came out, and they had like M16s and AK-47s and various weapons, and they lined up watermelons and cantaloupes and tin cans and stuff, and to show us what bullets would do to a watermelon, which was analogous to a human head as it exploded all over the place. Which was graphic and sort of got our attention, but you know, once you see one watermelon explode, you don't have to do it five times. You sort of get the point. It was going to be messy and it wasn't going to be pretty. So that was orientation for that. And they had set up a mock Vietnamese village, and they had a bunch of guys that dressed up in black pajamas and little cone hats and things. And they showed us various booby traps, like punchy snakes, tiger traps, and stuff like that, that really we were probably never going to see. But that was the same thing they used for the physicians. Some of the physicians could go out to the field units, and they were on aid stations when they were out there. So, you know, that was a more integrated kind of class. But the rest of it, in terms of learning how to march, which was hysterical, just hysterical. And the other military stuff was really kind of a joke. And everybody kind of took it that way. And then there was the pit. Nobody mentioned the pit to you yet?
Sure.
The pit was the officers' club that was over at the MFSS, which was the Medical Field Service School, where all the orientation took place. So this is, it was called Quadrangle because it was a quadrangle with a, you know, sort of plaza in the middle and four buildings all around it. And so terrified was I that I didn't want to salute anybody. I would walk all the way under the eaves, because if you were covered, you didn't have to salute anybody. But if you walked out, you would have to salute. Mm-hmm. And it was just an awkward thing to do. But in the basement of one of the buildings on the quad was the pit, and it was the officer. It was an annex to the officers' club. The real officers' club was elsewhere in the post, and it was very fancy and elegant. But this was just what it sounds like. It had a low ceiling. It was wall-to-wall smoke. It had the gummiest floors you can imagine, because they had beer and popcorn. And God knows what was on those floors. I don't think they ever changed them. And they had happy hour every night for at least an hour. You could get a pitcher of beer for like a buck. And so everybody would go over there and dance and smoke and drink and carry on until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then you'd go back to the barracks, which was, well, not the barracks, the BOQ. Mm-hmm. And just turn in for the night until you had to get up in the morning and go formation. You know, the toughest part was just packing in the morning when you're sort of clear-eyed. Fort Sam was a lot of fun, and being out of Camp Bullis was a lot of fun, too. Mm-hmm. The land navigation, we had a night navigation course. And with the land navigation, if you got from point A to point B to point C to point, the first team that did that, we did it in teams of, I think, 3 or 4. The first team that completed the course would get a prize. Well, a prize from the helicopter. We didn't know what that was. Mm-hmm. So one of the other nurses in the 71st, Brenda Johnson, and I were on a team with 1 or 2 other people, and we were first. Mm-hmm. And so we got to go ride in this helicopter. It was my first helicopter. Oh, God, it was such fun. We're banging all over, you know, temples. And look, and looking at cattle and scaring the cattle and making them move all over the place. It was just hysterical. It was a lot of fun. That was 6 or 8 weeks, I guess. Uh-huh. And from there I went to Valley Forge, Phoenixville, outside of Philadelphia. That was my first Phoenix station.
What did you think that the Army wanted its nurses to be? Nursing is normally a traditional feminine thing. Traditional woman's role, but it's the 60s. Mm-hmm. Things are starting to change in terms of, yeah, women and all of that. How do you think the military put itself in that.
Well, the military, you know, since World War II, actually since World War I, the nurse corps was established in 1902. And there had always been a small cadre of women officers. It wasn't until after World War II that they got commissions and really had rank like everybody else did. And nurses were always regarded differently than WACS, Women Army Corps. The stereotype of a WAC was a very butch, gay, lesbian, you know, kind of woman. Whereas nurses were nurses, and there is an unfortunate sexual stereotype that goes with nursing as well. You know, it was alive and well at the time, and there's still vestiges of it. You know, same thing with the stewardesses, the old stewardesses, you know, coffee, tea, or meat. For them, were things. And for us, it was, can I get your back rub? You know, that kind of stuff. But the Army, I think, had learned its lesson pretty well with World War II and Korea, that nurses had a real job. And the way the Army structured their hospitals, I thought was very efficient at the time. Now, bear in mind that the architecture of hospitals was very different back then. You had open bays where they would have 8, 10, 12 people. Then you had a few private rooms, usually for officers or people who were totally, you couldn't look at them because it made everybody else sick, or they were extremely contagious or whatever. Most things were open bay kind of a situation. And there was an enlisted staff, and then there was the officer staff. The enlisted staff was run by a wardmaster. He was the senior enlisted person for that particular ward. Then the officer staff, the nurse staff, was headed by a head nurse, and there would be a number of lower-ranking nurses. You know, usually the head nurse, prior to Vietnam, I think the highest-ranking nurses were like lieutenant colonels. I mean, that was really high-ranked for a career nurse. So most of the head nurses were like captains, and most of the staff nurses were lieutenants. Once Vietnam started kind of cranking, that changed, and you started getting a few more colonels. Colonels moved into places like Brooke Army Medical Center, Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Well, they were called General Hospitals, but Brooke General Hospital, Walter Reed General Hospital, Fitzsimmons, Letterman, Beaumont, you know, Paso, all of these big, big medical centers that were scattered around the country, and Valley Forge was another one. And the lieutenant colonels became more supervisory folks, and then you had majors and very junior lieutenant colonels who were head nurses, and captains and lieutenants were the staff nurses. And then there was always a ward officer who was a physician, and the physician was king of this particular realm. And invariably that was a male as well, because the women just weren't in the professional schools in great numbers at that point. And I don't think there were any women physicians in the military at that point, or very few. Probably count them on a couple of hands. But what did they expect out of it? I think they expected their nurses to be nurses. With one important exception, because there were fewer doctors in the military medical system than on the outside, where you have all these civilian doctors in practice and a lot of nurses in the hospital and a lot of doctors on a particular ward. You didn't have one who was in charge of the whole ward. You just had a lot of doctors and a lot of nurses, and they all interacted. There was usually only one or two physicians on a ward, and then the nurses ran everything else. And because there were so few doctors, nurses in the military were far more autonomous than our civilian counterparts. When I went to nursing school, we didn't draw blood, we didn't start IVs, we didn't catheterize men, we didn't do a lot of things. We didn't mix IVs. There were certain types of dressing that we could do. you know, just all kinds of things that were reserved for those with a medical license, or a nursing license. But in the Army, you did all. If you talk to any of the OR nurses, I'm sure they told you that, you know, a lot of times they would close. They would close in surgery. Because the docs were just moving on to this case, constantly working, and they couldn't attend to it. I don't want to say scut work, because it's not scut work, it's important work, but it has to get done, and they've got other things that they have to do. So the work of the doctors, I think, got spread around. Likewise, the work of nurses got spread around to LPNs, what we call 911 Charlie, and corpsmen. They did far more than nursing assistants or nurses aides ever did in the civilian world. So I think the military medical establishment was far ahead of the civilian practice in the 60s, you know, for that kind of thing. It's changed now. I think they're much more similar. Everybody does pretty much the same kind of stuff. You know, because really the medical establishment has gotten over its ego, and which was a lot of the barrier, I think, to the nurses doing things. It wasn't the nurses couldn't, it's the physician wouldn't let them. So, and that's the big change. But that has nothing really to do with the military, other than the military was ahead of its time. We're also ahead of it in terms of pay. Because when I got out of the Army, I was out for 5 years because I had a baby and couldn't be pregnant. And I went looking for a job after my son was born. He was about 14, no, I guess he was about 16, 18 months old. I was going crazy, just going nuts. I couldn't stand up working. And so I was looking for a job, and everything paid half of what I had been making as a captain in the Army. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. This was in Colorado Springs. And I finally got a job teaching, which had great hours, and I had the summers off, and I could take the lower salary because it had all those kinds of benefits. But in the Army, we were getting paid as lieutenants or captains or majors or whatever, instead of being paid as nurses or doctors or pilots or mechanics or truck drivers or whatever you happened to be. You were paid by your rank. And that was, to me, I thought, you know, wow, that's very funny. I think being in the Army actually made me probably more of a feminist than I would have been otherwise in that kind of thing. It certainly made me a lot more assertive and in some cases aggressive and impatient with stupidity and dumb rules. God knows, you know, we have dumb rules. Plenty of dumb rules. But then, you know, the civilian world has just a very dumb rule.
What kinds of things that made you more feminist? What kinds of things did you do or think that were different after?
Well,
okay.
For example, when I was teaching in Colorado Springs, I taught in an associate degree program and the LPN program at Community College. It was El Paso Community College at the time. Now I think it's Pikes Peak Community College. And I had my students at one of the hospitals in Colorado, which shall remain nameless. And we had, one of my students I had assigned to a lady who had breast cancer. And she had, I think, partial mastectomy. It was really just kind of getting started on the road for treatment and all that kind of stuff. And this was in the early 70s, so, you know, it was still pretty radical surgery. The prognosis was not all that great for most folks and all that kind of stuff. And so with my student, we devised this perfectly idealistic care plan of how we were going to teach this woman about breast cancer and cancer treatment and all of that kind of stuff. Well, I was in a post-clinical conference with my group of students that was about 6 or 8 students. And her surgeon came in and proceeded to rip me a new one, just up one side, down the other, in front of my students, because I had the audacity to be talking to his solicitations about her cancer without his permission. And, I mean, my jaw dropped. And I thought, you arrogant ass. You know, why shouldn't this woman know about her disease? Why shouldn't she know about treatment? Why shouldn't she know about that there will be pain, but there will be benefit, you know, all those kinds of things. And, you know, it was one of the things that I learned pretty early in Vietnam is you don't lie to your patients. Don't lie. If it's going to hurt, you tell them it's going to hurt. I mean, I did lie about the maggots. You didn't really tell people they had maggots crawling out of there, but they were doing good things, so you just told them a little white lie. But if one of your patients said, am I going to die? I mean, the worst you would say is, I don't know. You wouldn't tell them no. Because you just never knew. I mean, we had patients that came in that looked like they were in pretty good shape, and they would get an infection. You know, that's what they happen quite frequently. So you just never knew. So we all learned pretty early not to lie to patients. That was back before all these concepts of a fully informed consent and advanced directives and patients being, you know, the concept of a healthcare team was new, really new. And Colorado Springs was not exactly cutting edge that way. This particular hospital, especially, and this doctor complained. In fact, he went down and complained to the chief nurse of that hospital, like the director of nursing. And she called me down and she asked what had gone on. I told her. And she backed me up. She backed me up and I come. So, I mean, I didn't lose my job or I didn't lose the ability to have my students on that floor or anything else. I didn't resign anybody in his patients. I wasn't going to be stupid. But, I mean, it flabbergasted me that he would have the gall. That he would do it, number one, to begin with, without just saying, why were you, you know, what was your conversation with my patient, or what were you talking about, or what was going on? You know, and it wasn't that his patient was upset. Mm-hmm. His patient had simply said, the student and her instructor talked to me about, and can you give me some more information? It was that kind of a, she had asked her doctor for more information, and he was offended. So, you know, that just really irked me, and I had never been treated that way in the military at all. And then my husband that I had met in Vietnam was at the Air Force Academy, stationed at the Air Force Academy, and we were living there, on the Air Force Academy. Okay. Oh, we were at the Air Force Academy, yeah. And I mean, there were a couple of things that happened those first couple of years after I got back from Vietnam. Got married and had my goal and living out there. We were at a cocktail party for part of some of the faculty members at the academy. And of course there were no women in the academy at the time. I think it was the Commandant of Cadets, who was the one surgeon, came up and asked me my opinion, because this was in 73, 74, so there was a lot of discussion about whether or not women were going to be admitted to the academies, and if so, when. I mean, it was really heated, and everybody had an opinion, right? And we were at this cocktail party, and this guy comes up to me, and he wanted to know what I thought about women in the academy. And I said, well, if they can do the work, if they can pass the physical, if they can meet the requirements, the academic and military requirements, why not? I said, especially the Air Force Academy that was the baby academy. It was only 20 years old at the time. It was established in the 50s. And had only been out there at Colorado Springs for about 10 years, I think. Why not? We chit-chatted back and forth a little bit, and that was kind of the end of that discussion. Well, the next thing I know, my husband came back from work the next day, and he said, what did you tell him? So I recounted the conversation. you know, and it wasn't a heated argument or anything mm-hmm. like that. But I did let him know that, you know, my opinion was probably not the prevailing opinion of men at the Air Force, men on faculty at the Air Force Academy at the time. And Mike said, he called me in on the carpet and said, I needed to take care of my wife's opinion. I said, he what? And, you know, Mike knew better. You know, he hadn't been born the night before. And he said, no, no. You know, he sort of, back off. He said, I just sort of blew it off, and I know you're going to have your own opinion. Damn right I am, you know. And then another thing that happened was we had gone back, my husband was from Minnesota. We had gone back to Minneapolis for Christmas and New Year's. Michael had been born in November, and so this was the first time for the grandparents to see their new grandson, blah, 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 all that stuff. And so we went to the VFW for New Year's Eve, and Mike's dad had been in the Navy, I think, in World War II. His mother was active in the VFW auxiliary, and his dad was very active in the VFW. And we went there, and it was a nice party and everything. And, of course, the membership committee sort of clustered around Mike, and I was standing with Mike. And they started saying, well, do you want to join the VFW? And Mike was saying, well, yeah, sure, I don't see why not. You know, it's a nice club, and you come here, and you can party and stuff. I mean, the average age was probably about 60 there, so they were trying to get younger people in. And I said, what about me? Can I join? I'm a veteran of a foreign war. And they said, no, you're not. You're not a veteran. You can join the auxiliary. So that pissed me off. You know, it was just all these little things that, because I had been there and done that, I really was offended that nobody was taking it to mean anything. It didn't mean a damn thing. Same thing happened to my mother. I don't know if I was telling you the story, but when my mother and father divorced after like 29 years of marriage, and a couple of years after that, my mother developed breast cancer. And at that time, they had not passed the former spouse protection act that allows former spouses of military, if you were married for X number of years and if the military member served for X number of years, it's a big formula that they have, they can retain some medical benefits and some dental benefits and commissary and PS privileges. You know, it's complicated. So my mother really had no medical benefits, and she was trying to figure out where she was going to get treated. And so she went to the VA, and they told her they couldn't treat her because she wasn't real bad. And she had been in World War II, she had been in Europe, she had been in North Africa, she'd been in Europe. She was the first woman into one of the, it was the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. It was still smoking. It was still smoldering. She had been on little neurosurgical teams that it would be a neurosurgeon, an OR tech, and my mother, and they would go out and do neurosurgery out, you know, 2 miles behind the front lines, actually, the front lines in Europe. And they told her that she wasn't no veteran. And I thought, you know, what's going on with this? I mean, that's one of the things with Linda Vandermeer's book. At great personal cost to Linda, she aired a lot of dirty military linen about how women veterans had been treated and what they had gone through. I mean, Linda's story wasn't everybody's story. It was hers. But a lot of what she wrote in terms of how she was treated as a veteran were common to all of us. And that got the ball rolling. And I fully credit Linda with opening up the VA, with opening up the military hospitals to women retirees, you know, former WACs and retired Army nurses and all those kinds of folks that really had been shunted aside and ignored and trivialized over the years. And I gave Linda all the credit in the world for that. And my mother, died eventually of old age. I mean, she was a breast cancer survivor for like 30 years. But in her last couple of years, she was in an assisted living facility, and she developed cervical cancer. And she was treated at the, she had been treated at the Martinsburg VA near where I live. She was treated there, and she got all her medical care there. And they couldn't have been more wonderful. They followed up on all her appointments. They made sure, you know, that she was going to be there. They called me. They called the assisted living facility to make sure that everything was in order. She was seen about it. She had asthma and hypertension, a couple of things. And she was seen regularly and all this sort of stuff. And that's how, you know, the Pap smear came back positive. She had more diagnostic workups. She wound up going to the VA in Baltimore and the University of Maryland Hospital. They share facilities. And she was treated beautifully there. I mean, just beautiful. She died in her sleep. She didn't die of cancer. You know, she died in her sleep when she was 78. But she was finally treated well by the VA. And so, you know, I have... there are a lot of bad stories about the VAs, and there are some bad VAs. I know, like, just like there are bad civilian hospitals, there are some bad military hospitals. But on the whole, you know, they're under-resourced, underfunded, and doing the best they can with what they got. So, you know, I think they've done a good job. That's really off track.
What were you were you stationed at the 71st for your whole year?
Yeah.
Yeah. What tours did you?
I was on post op with Joan Fury and Linda Vandermeer and Laura Fichet, who's not here. Brenda Johnson is not here. I think actually Joni's the only other one from post op who's here. A couple of ER and OR nurses. We were in what was called the surgical T. The long leg of the T was the emergency room, the surgical clinic, X-ray, and then the cross piece of the T. One wing was the operating room, and the other side was post-op, and that in turn was divided in half. One half was the recovery area, and the other was the ICU. And recovery area, it's just what it sounds like, you know, they wake up from anesthesia. If they didn't need to be in the ICU, and it was still daylight, they would recover, and we would send them up in the surgical wards. If it was after, usually about 7 or 8 o'clock, once it got dark, we didn't transfer patients at night because we got hit. We never got hit during the day, but we got hit at night. So we never transferred anybody at night, and any recovery cases would have to stay until the next morning. And I worked usually in the recovery side. I did ICU too, but I preferred recovery, treatment, you know, kind of thing, just get it out of here. I liked it. If there were patients on a striker frame, they wound up on the recovery side just because we had more room. The beds were smaller because they were recovery-type beds, unless we had overflow. And then, you know, we'd use the regular hospital-type crank beds instead of recovery beds because they were kind of flimsy and not very comfortable at the idea of very long. And then towards the back, if there were any expecting patients, they would put back there. 4 hours. But it was, you know, there I was about 6-8 months out of school. And we were talking about this outside. And a lot of us, Sarah was the same way. She had just graduated. I think we graduated the same day, different schools the same day. And there we were, brand new out of school. Wet, so wet behind the ears. Oh my God, we were behind the ears. Didn't know anything. And everybody saw to it that you learned immediately. Fortunately, I had 3 months at Valley Forge. She had 3 months at Fort Dix. And both of us wound up in situations in those different facilities where the people that we worked with had been in Vietnam, and they knew where we were going. You know, they said, okay, we got fresh meat here, but you're not going to be here long. And I had been there about 2.5 months when the assistant chief nurse of the hospital came and took me into the supply room. I thought she was kind of kinky, but she said, no, I'm giving you orders. You're on alert. You're going to Vietnam in 6 weeks. Oh, okay, fine, cool.
Did you volunteer?
Well, if I hadn't gone within six, I gave myself 6 months.
Okay.
If they didn't send me in 6 months, I was going to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured I needed to learn some stuff first. But the doctor on my ward had come back from Vietnam about 6 months before I got to Valley Forge. And he said, do you know how to draw blood? Have you ever started an IV? Do you know how to do this kind of dressing change? Do you know how to do that? Do you know how to, you know, do all, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G? And I said, No. You know, I was in a baccalaureate school of nursing, and the difference back then between the baccalaureates and the hospital schools was the hospital diploma-trained nurses could do, well, this was the rhetoric anyway, they could do, we could think. That was the story. Within about a year, everything evened out because they learned how to think and we knew learned how to do. Well, we were supposedly had the theoretical why everything was being done, but we didn't know how to do it. But the corpsman that I worked with at Valley Forge and Dr. Morgan especially just made sure that I did all this stuff, and I drew all the labs every day. I mean, it got so I could draw blood on a rock. I wasn't terribly proficient with IVs because we didn't start a lot of IVs. They usually came back from the OR with an IV and we would discontinue them. We didn't start a lot on my board. So I didn't really get proficient with starting IVs until I got to Vietnam. And again, it became, you know, you could do it in the dark. and you know, when we had alerts and stuff at night and all the lights went off, you were literally doing those kinds of things. You didn't start in the dark. But I mean, you went around, you had to check the patients, crawling around in the dark. They were either on the floor or they were sandwiched in between mattresses, and you just had to feel and make sure that everything was okay. Just like a little flashlight to see if the IV was still dripping through all that stuff. I mean, you learn to improvise, and you learn to improvise and overcome. Improvise, adapt, and overcome, I guess I would say. There were times when we would have, it's things sort of ran in runs of kinds of patients. Like we would get nothing but neurosurgical cases for a week. And then we'd get nothing but gut wounds, and then we'd get nothing but chests, and you know, and then we'd have a mix. And it seemed like at one time we had a real run on chest wounds, and so they got chest tubes, which meant they had to be attached to suction. We only had 3 or 4 suction machines in the ICU, and I think they had 1 or 2 in the OR. So we had tubing going from these couple of little Emerson suction machines that were just pumping their little hearts out, just sucking away, and we had tubing going under beds to other patients, you know, from patient to patient to patient, and from chest tube bottle to another set of tubing. I mean, it was, I'm sure they were getting nothing better than gravity drainage, which was good enough, but, you know, and there was one doctor that actually rigged up a Wangenstein suction because we ran out of Gonco suction, which is a drainage system for stomach, but that was based on gravity principles. I mean, it was like the original, how do you get the contents of the stomach out? Well, you rig up all these tubes and something is lower than something else is high. You know, it's all these principles of water seeking its own level in physics that I never took and all that. He rigged up one of those because we ran out of machines. Every once in a while, the generators would go out, you know, and then you'd have to, oh well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these days, when generators go out, it's a major catastrophe because everybody's hooked up to all these monitors and machines, do everything. And we just didn't have machines to do that. We had very little machinery. And I guess that was a big lesson for me in what I learned out that first year was the basics. Skills of how to look at somebody and tell us if things were right or not, and how to, you know, what things smelled right and what things didn't smell right, and what was a good color and what was not a good color, and what certain things felt like crepitus. We're talking, and I've asked probably 100 nurses over the last 5 years or so, do you know what crepitus feels like? And they'll say no. They don't know. And I'm thinking, how can you have patients with trachs and not know what crepitus feels like, or
patients who have chest tubes and not feel around where the chest tube is. You know, you've got to check for these, because that could be really serious, especially around the trach. And, you know, that's one of the skills that there's such a reliance on the machinery and the technology, which is wonderful. The technology is absolutely incredible. But there comes a point where you don't have that. And I guess that's what I'm seeing in the job that I have now, which is I go to some third world countries where clinical research is going on, and you go into a clinic in Kisumu, Africa, and they don't have the machinery. They have a stethoscope, and they have eyes, and they have band-aids, and they have some IVs. But beyond that, you know, their blood pressure is not taken by a machine, it's taken by a person. And it's done the right way, and the cuff is put in the right place, and the stethoscope is put over the artery and not somewhere over the elbow on the outside. Because this country is just so enamored of technology. We can't get away from it. We don't know what to do without it. And I think we need to know what to do without it. We're getting some real trouble here. And I'm sure those poor folks in Baghdad are going through exactly the same thing that we did. You know, they have better equipment than we did. I mean, when I was in Desert Storm, we had much better equipment than what we had in Vietnam. But it was still very much a gut instinct, this is right, this is wrong, with this patient kind of a thing. Because we didn't have MRIs in Iraq or Saudi Arabia. We didn't have ultrasound. Well, we had some Dopplers. We didn't have ultrasound. We had X-ray. You know, so it was on a technology scale by today's standards, still rather primitive, even though that was only 1991. And in Baghdad right now, I'm sure they're not doing fancy care plans. And I'm sure the paper trail is getting is probably fairly shoddy. But I don't think they're worrying too much about it. I don't think the Joint Commission's going to go over and inspect them anytime soon. So they don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. They just need to get the patient back. You know, treat them, stabilize them, get them as good as you can get them. And God love them, from what I'm hearing. They're multiple amputees and they're heavy. Because the body armor is so much better. So you don't get the gut injuries and the chest injuries. But it's blindness and it's facial injuries and it's head injuries. Losses of arms and they're surviving their wounds just like they did in Vietnam, but they're just such devastating wounds. You know, what's going to happen to those guys? I don't know. That worries me. Now, I have thoughts about the war in Iraq and all that kind of stuff, but I'm thinking more about, you know, what's happening to those patients? What's going on with them? And what's going on with the medical staff? That's now been extended. I mean, I know how much we all colored in our short-timers calendars, and, you know, they don't know when they're coming home, and they didn't know in World War II either, and, you know, so I can't feel too sorry for them, because they're, you know, our parents, my parents, they were there for the duration. And when I got orders for Desert Storm, it was for the duration plus one. And they never said whether that was one day, 1 month, 1 year. You know, it wasn't really clear. It was kind of vague at first. Uh-huh. I mean, these folks don't have an endpoint. They don't really see it yet.
Did you sign up again in the Army to go to Desert Storm?
No. When I got out of the Army the first time, because I had to, I was pregnant. But then they changed the regulations. And I came back in, and came back on active duty, and stayed in. So I stayed in for a total of 27 years. And my last, I retired in 1993, so I volunteered to go to Desert Storm. But it was very different, because when I left to go to Vietnam, my parents took me to the airport in Fayetteville. My dad was stationed at Fort Bragg, and took me to Fayetteville Airport. I was flying to California to go fly to Vietnam. And I was so excited. I mean, I was going off on the adventure of my life, and I was an only child. I was so eager to leave my parents, leave the nest. You know, Fort Bragg is only 70 miles from Duke. So I saw my parents
as much as I wanted, and sometimes a little bit more. So I was, you know, this was, I was on my own, I was going away, and I was all excited, charged up about this, you know, very naive, very stupid, absolutely fearless. I had no clue. And then when I went to Iraq, I also volunteered to go to Desert Storm. In fact, I rigged it because I was working for the chief nurse at Walter Reed, and I was getting all the names, and I was talking to the people at Fort Sam Houston who were making the assignments. And I said, well, and he said, I need more names. And I said, what about me? Oh, do you want to go? Sure. I mean, and everybody else said, no, you can't volunteer. They won't let you go. So I circumvented my chief nurse, who, I don't know if she knows that or not. She's a sweet lady. I like her. But the hardest thing I ever did, as hard as Vietnam, the hardest thing I ever did was to get on the airplane to go to Fort Jackson so that I could go over to the desert, get on the airplane in Washington, and say goodbye to my three kids and my husband. I mean, because my daughter was third grade, my younger son was sixth grade, and my older son was a senior in high school. And he was already in the delayed entry program. So he was going to be going to the Army as soon as he graduated from high school. And I was the last one to get on the plane. I waited until everybody else was gone. I didn't want to say goodbye. I wasn't, you know, pretty good. I knew I was getting really emotional, but I wasn't crying. I didn't want my kids to see me crying. And they were crying. Samantha and Andrew were crying. And my husband said probably the sweetest thing that he ever said to me when he hugged me. He said, keep your fucking head down. And I thought that was, I told him, I said, that's the sweetest thing you've ever said to me. It really was. I was really touched. And I, you know, it sounds facetious, but I'm quite serious about that. You know, he was, that was his way of saying, come back. But he took the two little ones out, and I turned back and looked around, and my son was standing there saluting me, and I lost him. I mean, I'm about to lose it now. But, I mean, I totally, I got on the plane just sobbing, cuddled up in there, huddled up by the, you know, in the corner of the seat, and just sobbed and sobbed. And I had a book of crossword puzzles with me, and I immediately started looking at crossword puzzles. And I just couldn't even think about it. I could not think about it. So I got down to Fort Jackson, and we were there for about 5 days because they said, you know, they actually issued us weapons, and we had to qualify with them, and we had to fit the gas masks and everything else. And they gave us uniforms, you know, they got us all set, and before they sent us off. And so I called, and I talked to my kids, and I talked to my husband before we finally got on the airplane to leave the country. But that was another big difference, because when I left out of Travis, I just drove out to the airport. I mean, I was drunk as a skunk when I got on the plane for a variety of reasons, which is a whole other story. The only person drunker than me was the stewardess, who was throwing up in the bathroom. Oh, yeah, it was a great story. When we got on the buses to leave Fort Jackson, they had us all in a separate area where everybody that was deploying to Desert Storm was in these barracks, and you know, it was a constant turnover of people. We were only there 3 to 5 days, and then we were deployed out on the planes flying out of Charleston. And we went on buses from Fort Jackson to Charleston. And Fort Jackson is a very large basic training installation. So they have all these basic trainees, these young kids, they're just, you know, buzz cuts, and, you know, hair, and just, you know, fresh out of high school, still had their pimples and everything. But when the buses pulled out, and apparently this happened every time the buses pulled out, because they always pulled out at the same time. They took us there at about 6 or 7 o'clock every night. And this gets me choked up, too. The roads were lined, and they were all swooping. Yeah, it was just, oh, and I lost it then. And then we got to the Charleston airport, and the Red Cross was there 24 hours a day. And they had ditty bags for us with, you know, cards and everything we needed. Pillows, phones for us to call home. You know, it was just so different because the country was behind the troops this time.
You know, I guess there were, you know, people were behind the war, behind the invasion of, you know, going into Iraq to liberate Kuwait. People were really supportive of that and supportive of what the military was doing. The military was viewed in a very positive light at that point. And still is, I think, largely. But that was so different from when we got back from Vietnam, and then when I was in the Army in the late 70s and in the 80s. I mean, it was god-awful. When we got back, my dad told me to take my military stickers off my car because it was, since if I was going to go to Washington, D.C., he said, take the stickers off the car. He said, you'll get your windshield bashed in, you'll get your headlights bashed in, something will happen. We didn't go anywhere in uniforms. You know, you just went to work in uniform and you drove straight home and drove straight to work and you didn't go anywhere in between once you had the stop for gas. It was just not a popular thing to be. And you know, I never could get over people calling nurses and doctors baby killers, but they did. I didn't get spit at or anything like that. But on my way back, I went through Seattle, Tacoma, and then had a flight to Chicago, and then to North Carolina. And I was in Chicago waiting for my plane, and I had a great tan, because my future husband had left on New Year's, and this was like the end of February, the first couple of days of March, when I came back. So the minute he left, I went on permanent nights, so I could go to the pool and bake and baste. Mm-hmm. And I had a great tan. So anyway, I was sitting in the airport, and this guy was a very nicely dressed businessman, you know, probably late 20s, early 30s, something like that. And he made some comment, like, you really have a nice tan. You must have been to Hawaii or the Caribbean or someplace. I said, no, I was in Vietnam, you know, just didn't even think about it. He gave me a really dirty look, got up and left. He wouldn't even sit next to me. And I thought, well, you're a jerk, you know. But that was the worst thing that ever happened to me personally. I know worse things happen to other people and to my friends. And, you know, everybody's got a little story or a big story. Some are a lot worse than others. I think really my re-entry, if you want to call it that, was buffered because I stayed in the Army for another year and a half. And when you're around Army people, those are people that most of them have, if not been through the same situation, been through very similar. There were nurses who had been to Korea, and a lot of the corpsmen had been to Vietnam and had come back, and of course a lot of patients were there from Vietnam. So we all told our war stories, and it was acceptable. And I think, to this day, I think that some of the people that had the most difficulty were the ones who came back to San Francisco or Seattle, out-processed from the military immediately, and went to work in a civilian hospital or a civilian practice or a civilian facility, and where they didn't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. They did not want to hear those stories, and they couldn't talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think having the ability to share those stories and those experiences with people that had been through the same thing was very cathartic. I mean, it was for me. There are a lot of people here that either were diagnosed or self-diagnosed with PTSD and had very difficult periods in their lives. I didn't, and I really think that a lot of that was because I stayed in the military. And I loved what I was doing. And I felt like I had always done the right thing, and what I had done was good. And because I was in that particular little environment, that military medical environment, nobody told me otherwise. You know, the press might have been telling me something else, or, you know, Walter Cronkite or somebody might have been saying something different. But they weren't the people that I worked with. They weren't the people that were important to me. They weren't my family. My parents supported me fully. I mean, they knew. My first husband was Air Force. He had been there. We met there. He knew. He supported me. My second husband was he didn't go to Vietnam, but he served in the military, and he was a medic in the was a corpsman during the mid-70s. So he knew many, many people who'd been there. And he said, and you know, he supported me for the rest of my career. He became a dependent, you know, military spouse, and you know, was a camp follower for the rest of our marriage. And so, you know, I never got the feeling that what I did was wrong or bad or that I had to suffer for it. You know, the difficult times in my life were when my daughter was killed. I mean, bar none, that was it. Slam dunk, that's the worst time in my life ever. And that's what really has affected me in my life. Now, did Vietnam affect me? Absolutely. I mean, it's probably the single most important year of my entire life. Would I go back and do it? I'd do it in a heartbeat. I'd do it in a heartbeat. If you asked me to do it right now, I'd say, sure. I would absolutely do it. No regrets. None whatsoever. Don't know that I would do anything different. Might not have gone to Singapore. Might have gone to Bangkok instead. But, you know, I mean, those are silly things. You know, and I think I probably would have tried to have stayed in touch with more people. And I would have been a better friend to Jude Larkin while he was dying. I couldn't handle him dying. I didn't see him about the last year and a half of his life because I couldn't deal with it. And I didn't see Linda Vandevan. I saw her about 3 years before she died, and I talked to her a lot. I mean, she called me when my daughter died, and I mean, she was so sweet. And the last time I talked to her was just a couple months before she died, and it was so unexpected. You know, I knew Linda was sick, but I didn't think she'd die. So, I mean, that's the only regret that I have, is that I wasn't a better friend to some of those folks that, you know, and especially now that we're getting older. More of us are going to be going that particular route. So I want to, and I'm glad I came here to see these people again.
We'll end this.